How do I get real about authenticity,
right,
Joe?
Right, exactly. We actually have these axioms of authenticity where you say, you know, if you are authentic, don't say you're authentic, right? Number one. Because number two, if you say you're authentic, then people are not going to perceive you as authentic. And the easiest way to be authentic is not to say you're authentic. So you don't want to say it, right? You just want to do things. And so we have in there the two key standards of authenticity. And these actually flow from what we think is really the first time that authenticity came to the fore in English literature, and that's Shakespeare's play Hamlet, the most existential of plays, to be or not to be and all that. But the most fake character in the play is Polonius. And there's this scene where he's giving this long series of advice to his son Laertes, who's about to go off to France. And he gives him platitude after platitude and cliche after cliche until the very end, Polonius, or rather Shakespeare through Polonius, says something profound, something that's never been said before, right? And this above all, to thine own self be true.
Thanks for pressing play. This is Christopher Lockhead, Follow Your Different. And we aspire to have real conversations, not canned interviews, that celebrate the amazing people who are making a difference by being different. And man, do we ever have that today with our guest, Joe Pyne. We are sponsored by the good folks at Oracle NetSuite. Learn how to turbocharge the growth of your business today at netsuite.com/different. And while you're there, you will be able to set up a free 1-hour growth review with an expert in your industry at netsuite.com/different. Now, Joe Pyne, today I got to hang out with really one of the godfathers of what you could call the experience economy. And Joe is a legit business thought leader. You know, in a world where some people call themselves thought leader in their Instagram or in their LinkedIn profile. I don't know if you've seen this one too on Instagram and maybe on Facebook. You know how many people are public figures? Anyway, Joe Pyne is a no BS business thought leader who approximately 20 years ago with his partner wrote an incredible book called The Experience Economy. This was before the big comeback of Apple. And while Starbucks was out and off to the races, they certainly weren't what they are today. And Joe and his partner really called the ball on what was going to be the big lever of competitive advantage going forward. And frankly, I still believe it is today. And that's this notion of delivering legendary experiences. On this episode, Joe unpacks the four types of experiences. He asks the question that I think all people, all companies should ask, which is, are you a brand that people spend time with or save time with? We also get into what comes after experience as a competitive advantage. Of course, Joe's done some thinking about that, and frankly, it's a very big idea. We also unpack the keys to authenticity. Joe shares a radical idea to save Facebook from itself, and a lot more. Go to Lockhead.com to check out more information on Joe's background, his amazing books, the show notes, and get the key takeaways for this episode. Now, hey-ho, let's go.
We actually opened the book, chapter one, with, you know, consider a coffee bean, because it is a true commodity that you grow in the ground. And if you look at how much of a coffee bean is in your cup of coffee, it's actually only 2 or 3 cents. But then if you take those beans, you grind them, roast them, package them, put them on a grocery store shelf. Now you buy physical goods, and that your cup of coffee is worth 5, 10, 15 cents of the goods. You buy it as a service where somebody brews it for you in a corner diner, bodega, kiosk, or vending machine somewhere. Now it's 50 cents, dollar, dollar and a half. And in the book in 1999, we didn't mention Starbucks by name. Now we always do in presentations. But yeah, if you go to a Starbucks and enjoy the ambiance and the theater of them making this for you, enjoy spending time in the place that they have created, then now you're paying, you know, $3, $4, $5 for a cup of coffee. So perfectly exemplifies that progression of economic value. And you think about Apple as a digital example, yes, but you know, in 2002, you remember how long ago it was? It was 2002 when Steve Jobs announced they were going into retail. with the Apple stores. And you may not remember this either, but they, but he actually got lambasted in the business press. They thought he was crazy, you know, as a manufacturer, a designer going into retail. He said, you're just going to tick off your channel partners. You don't know retail. You're going to fail at it. And he proved them wrong by not just creating a retail store, but creating a retail experience. And that's what the Apple stores have always been. And obviously the experience at an Apple store is predicated on the great products. But when you combine the great products that Apple has with the great experience they have in their stores, well, that's when magic can happen.
Yes.
And those are the companies that other companies need to learn from and understand what they're doing, because they are really pioneers of the experience economy.
And on one hand, I look at it and go, okay, so it's undeniable is today. Experience has got to be a core competency of a company. And so this is going to lead me to a question. So you guys are the fathers of this idea, and I think you should be, you know, celebrated for it. And at the same time, there are all these other companies that are like, I think that Comcast, United Airlines, and American Airlines are in a death battle to see who can be the shittiest company on the planet.
Yes. Yes.
Right. And unfortunately, we just had the passing of Herb Kelleher,
right,
one of my heroes. And you can know which company is governed by something greater than a spreadsheet just when you call them. Right. Because when you call Southwest, you have a human experience because a human being answers the phone.
Exactly.
And when you call the assholes at American Airlines, a digital asshole answers the phone and you continue to get treated that way throughout. And so I guess this leads me to a question, Joe, which is, on one hand, experience is an is, and yet on another hand, Comcast still sucks. And so how can that still be true? How can Comcast still be such assholes in the experience economy?
It boggles my mind too. You know, like, I don't know, how can you not understand what's going on? But it's not just Comcast, and I would have to add that United Airlines is my choice for, you know, at the bottom. They're all,
I hate them
all
too.
The bad experiences I've had on airlines have been with United, and you know, recently, you know, what they've done and everything. But there's a lot of companies that still don't get. I mean, look at the demise of Toys R Us. Right, last year, which has the most experiential product in the world, you know, even more than smartphones, that toy kids love to play, and yet they put them in a warehouse where the last thing they can do is actually play with the toys in there, you know. And Sears, you look at them, right? They're in bankruptcy. They may be able to come out. Sears, you can actually understand more. Because they, you know, they've had this long 100-plus-year run where they were number one, and it wasn't just Amazon that killed them. They had problems with Walmart and so forth, but they never understood the value of experience. And you can't, you know, I actually wrote an article, a digital article for the Harvard Business Review, wrote one just a month ago on Toys R Us coming out of bankruptcy, but I wrote another one a year before that about retailers that basically said, look, you got two choices. You can have a time well saved strategy and provide the best possible service at the lowest possible price with the greatest possible convenience. The only problem with that is you're competing against Walmart and Amazon if you do that. Or you can provide a time well spent strategy where people actually value the time that they spend with you. And that's what retailers really need to understand, as well as the Comcast and the Uniteds and all the others, is you got to get people to value the time that they spend with you. Give them a reason to come into the store. Give them a reason to interact with you, whether it's over the phone or live in person, or even through your devices. Otherwise, so they'll just go someplace else.
Joe, I want to make sure I got that. In business today, our experience strategy should be time well saved or time well spent.
Correct.
You know, you're very smart. You should write some books.
I'll take that under advisement.
Yeah, no, you might be onto something in terms of a career here, Joe. That's a very powerful way of thinking of it, right? I either want to be a convenience play where I'm in and out, I'm efficient. Obviously, yep. Price is going to be a critical part of it, you would imagine. But convenience, people will pay some premiums for convenience. We all sign up for Amazon Prime, right? Mm-hmm. Or time well spent. Now, the interesting thing to me is, you know, I read all these marketing and advertising things, as I'm sure you read lots of them, and all these surveys, everything says that today, not just millennials, but people in general, well, we don't want as many things. We want to buy experiences.
Exactly.
And so does that mean, in your opinion, and you may be biased, but I don't give a shit, that a time well spent strategy is a smarter strategy than a time well saved strategy? Or how do you think about that?
Yes, for most companies. You know, I don't say everybody has to embrace experiences and shift into the experience economy, but it certainly is the thing that most companies need to do. And exactly as you say, is that, you know, there's been a lot of studies on millennials desiring experiences over things. There's a lot of other studies that says whatever generation you're in, like buying experiences makes us happier than buying things. And it is not just a generational thing. The thing about the millennials, though, why it's so important there is that, one reason is that they're the first generation to grow up in the experience economy, that they were kids when we shifted into it. So they've always been this way, and now they want to continue that. But every generation desires experiences over things. Every generation, it makes us happier to buy experiences over things. So you've got to figure out how to do that. You know, like even on the luxury end, you know, LVMH, the big manufacturer of luxury goods, they just bought last month Belmond, which is a experience staging company. They own hotels, they own rail, train experiences in Europe and so forth. And they specifically said, you know, that it's because we need to provide more experiences, that the luxury spend on today is more than 50% on experiences and less than 50% on physical goods. And again, it's not just in that luxury segment, it's all the way down.
So if I'm a company that makes stuff and therefore wants you to buy my stuff, and I'm reading all this and people want less stuff and more experiences, how do I go from thinking about myself as a make stuff business to a deliver experiences business?
Well, if in terms of making that shift, one of the steps to make is actually to do like Apple did and create experiences that generate demand for your core offerings, for your physical goods. And often that's the best thing you can do. One of the early examples of that, and one of my favorite examples, is American Girl. I don't know if you've got girls that grew up with that, but you know, both my daughters were just so big into American Girl before they came out with their first stores. You know, it was a catalog company originally. You bought via mail, like Sears catalog. And then in 1998, they opened up their first American Girl place just off the Magnificent Mile in Chicago. And when they did it, it's not just a store. It's again, retail experience. They say that the average person going through that store didn't leave for 4 hours. Imagine being in a retail store, 30,000 square feet or so, for 4 hours. Why? Because of all the experiences they could have. You know, from the museums and the dioramas to the a cafe where you can actually pay admission to have a cafe experience, a grown-up dining experience where with your own doll with its little place setting right by it. They have a photo shoot. They added a hair salon. They had a theater in the first two or three original American Girls where you could pay admission fee over $30 for a live stage production in the store. You know, I mean, why wasn't Disney the first person to put a theater inside of a store? But it was American Girl. And they showed that people would even desire to pay admission for the experience in a retail setting, you know, coming as a manufacturer. So there are many examples that you can go to Amsterdam and pay admission for the Heineken experience. You can go to Dublin to the Guinness storehouse. You can go to Wolfsburg, Germany and go to Autostadt, Volkswagen's theme park out there. You can go to Lego Imagination Centers, Lego theme parks, you know, around the world.
There's my favorite of those experiences. I have been to Scotland, where my family is originally from, in Edinburgh. They have the whiskey experience.
Yeah.
That's my kind of experience. And, you know, the interesting thing is I lovingly refer to them as smallie entrepreneurs. You know, biggie entrepreneurs go to Sand Hill Road and raise a couple hundred million dollars. Smallie entrepreneurs borrow some money from the bank or their uncle or their dad or whatever. Anyway, they're in the town I live in, Santa Cruz, there's this smallie entrepreneur. I don't know. I'm assuming it's a gal, but I have no idea. And the place is called Petroglyph. And There may be more than one of them. There's one in Santa Cruz, and there may be one or two others. I don't know. But it's a small business. And imagine a physical retail location, mm-hmm. big open area, and what they have are pre-made all sorts of stuff, like coffee cups and flower things and I don't know, stuff I don't, you know, I'm a dude, what do I know? And what you do is you bring your kids there and you paint on them. Yeah. So you paint a giraffe on the coffee mug or whatever it is you paint on it. And you can do a whole bunch of different things. They have all animal, they have whatever it is you can do. You spend a whole afternoon there painting stuff on ceramic stuff. And then you leave them the stuff and they fire glaze it or I don't know shit about any of this, but they, you know, they turn it into usable shit and you show back up a couple of days later and it's all ready to go. And like, ta-da, so it's an arts and crafts experience exactly. that you can go do with your kids. And the place is always jam packed and it's just a local business that the local community loves. And, you know, people do this, and rather than buy the kid something, you go and do a thing with the kid, right?
Right, right. And there you even end up with a physical good, right?
Yes.
You take home the mug or the plate or whatever it might be, but you made it yourself. You went through a crafting experience, and so it imparts yourself into the object, so it's going to be something you're going to treasure and keep, and then you had that time well spent. You know, for an hour or two in there, you were doing something that really made it into an experience.
Yeah, the other one I like in this regard, several years ago now, my wife and our next door neighbor wanted to get chickens. I'm like, I don't want chickens. They're loud and stupid and stinky. I don't want any chickens. Of course, we got chickens. And now I love them. They're my pride and joy. They're it turns out they're amazing animals and they're great pets. Anyway, my wife Carrie and our neighbor Kim, they went and they didn't just buy chicks, Joe. They had a chicken experience. So they went mm-hmm. to a local farm and they did a half day course with a group of other folks. And the gal who runs the farm teaches you everything you need to know about backyard chickening, which is yep. now a big thing. And then when you graduate, you get your chicks and you walk out with your little chicks and you now know how to care for them. And so this local farm that sells chicks was smart enough to not just sell the chicks. They created an experience. Of course, you need to learn right. this if you're getting into it anyway. And then you graduate and you get your chicks for graduation.
Right, right. Now, I want to point out something that you did there. And I assume you didn't do it that the chicken farmers did, but maybe it was you. But you called it chickening.
Right? Yes.
The chickening experience. And that ing, when you put ing on the end of any word, turn it into a gerund, it means that you're experiencing something. And that's one of the key things we talk about. We encourage companies to think in terms of ing words. You know, whether it's chickening, if you got to make it up, it's fine. You know, the chickening experience, or whether it's the driving experience, or whether it's the using experience, you know, whatever it might be. If you think in terms of ing words, you're naturally going to go towards experiences. And so that's another thing that we work with manufacturers on, is thinking about inging your things, right? How do you ing your thing and turn it into more of ing words?
And so do, maybe most is the wrong word, I don't know what word to use, but do you find there are a lot of companies that make stuff that can ing the stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you think of any way that you make it more sensorial. You know, so I'll give you an example of duct tape, right? Think about duct tape, plain old duct tape. And yet the duct tape company does a wonderful job of inging things with it, of having a contest, for example, like prom dresses. And, you know, and they give you out college scholarships for the best prom dresses made out of duct tape. So it's the prom, you know, dressing experience that you have. Or making purses out of it. They do things like colorize them and have different colors that they do. I mean, it's just they form clubs, you know, duct tape clubs and so forth. So I think you really can pretty much do it out of any physical good.
And that leads me to another sort of question about this inging business. Almost any company I can think of that has an experience that I enjoy, there's at least some, if not a large degree, there's at least a small degree of fun involved with it. And so do I have to, if I'm trying to experience, you know, deliver greater experiences, do I have to also have a fun mentality? Like, what would be a fun way to do this if I'm my customer?
Yeah, I would say not necessarily. In fact, you know, when we first came out with the book, we got a lot of complaints about Retailtainment and eatertainment. It's all about turning things into entertainment or Disneyfying things and so forth. But we have actually in chapter two of the book a framework where we define that there's four realms of experience, right? You can divide all experiences into these elements of four, of which most of them have it. And the first one's entertainment, yes. And there, of course, there's a huge entertainment industry, and that's one way to do it, where you make things fun and enjoyable. But secondly, there's educational. You can have educational experiences where people learn from those experiences. You know, think classically about museums and universities and things like that. But there's a lot of places. American Girl, another example. It was actually founded by a school teacher who wanted to teach girls about American history. Right, it is first and foremost an educational experience to play with their dolls, to read their books, to go to the store, and so forth. And then there's entertainment, educational. Then there are escapist experiences where you go from one place to another, right? And you're actively immersed in an environment. You know, tourism is all about escapist experiences. But even like an Apple store, that you are walking along and you see something like the glass cube in Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. It's like, this is so different. I want to be in there, not out here, but in there. And that's an escapist experiences. You think about things like Topgolf. You know, one of the fastest growing things in the sports world is a completely different format for playing golf, and it is an escapist experience. And then finally, there are aesthetic experiences, places where you just want to go hang out and be. And that's what a cafe, a Starbucks is classically, right? It's an aesthetic experience. You're not looking for fun there necessarily. You're looking for socialization or a place to relax and work, to read, whatever it might be. But also, again, many museums, if you're immersed in the artwork, that's an aesthetic experience, or landscaping, or being out in nature, going hiking in the woods, has both an element of escapist and of aesthetic, of immersion you in there.
So and the four E's are entertainment, education, escape, and aesthetic.
Correct. Correct.
And I'm also hearing some experiences, of course, incorporate elements of more than one, sometimes all four.
Exactly.
Lean more one way than the other.
Exactly. There may be elements of all four in sort of anything, but only in a minor degree. A lot of experiences center on one. But what we found is that the best experience, the most robust experiences hit the sweet spot in the middle, that have aspects of all four of them. And that's what you want to aim at. So you may have a center of gravity, we're fun with entertainment, but then how do you reach out to the others? What can people learn about what we're doing? And that's maybe like get behind the scenes. And you often see that at a Ford factory tour, where you can get behind the scenes and see how they're doing the factory. And how do you reach out to escapism and provide more activities that people can do, like the creative making of the design of the mugs and so forth that you talked about. And then escapists, how can we provide a place that people just want to hang out and be? And maybe that's just a respite from the rest of the experience, but a place where they value just being there.
Fascinating. And so the best experienced businesses have all components of it, but they focus on the areas that they really think they can differentiate on.
Right.
Now, I know when your book first came out, another pushback certainly I heard was like, oh, this is all nice and everything, but this is sort of like motherhood and apple pie, like a little sort of treat your customers nicely and all that. But like the spreadsheet set, if I could call them that, were like, this is a little soft. This is clearly a West Coasty thing. Yep. And yet, in a lot of ways, in the 20 years since the book came out, the realest stuff is the experience stuff. And so I'm just curious, what's your take now on the sort of people who still argue that, this is a little bit of a whimsical thing we do on when we have extra money that we don't need to give to our shareholders. But from a spreadsheet point of view, you'd never focus on this stuff.
Well, I'll guarantee you the people who said it 20 years have found out is that they've been commoditized in the meantime. And that's sort of in addition to time well spent and time well saved, it's sort of the epic struggle that we lay out in the experience economy is that you have two choices, right? You shift up this progressive economic value that we've talked about and get into experiences, or you'll end up shifting down and be commoditized, where you're treated like a commodity where people buy you basically on three things, price, price, and price, right? That's what commoditized is. So the spreadsheet mentality will often take companies down where they stop innovating, and they just end up being bought on price. You know, I give you an example here. I love is I was in Milan. This is probably 12 or 15 years ago now. I was doing a small boardroom presentation, maybe 10 or 12 executives. It was had to do with our book being translated into Italian. And one of the persons there was a vice president of Maxwell House in Europe. And he said something that amazed me. He said, you know, there's been no innovation in the coffee industry in 15 years. And I said, are you kidding me? Have you never heard of Starbucks? You know, because for him, innovation was as good. There was that spreadsheet mentality. That's stuff over there. That's not what we do. We manufacture coffee goods, you know. So that's what they did. And look what happened to Starbucks. I mean, if you think about it, Starbucks itself started as a manufacturer. There's no reason that Maxwell House couldn't have done that. We could have little Maxwell Houses, you know, thousands of Maxwell Houses around the country if they had thought about the need to innovate in experiences.
Incredible. And so where are we today in the experience economy, Joe? I mean, it seems like there is a bit of a bifurcation. There's the companies that get it and the companies that don't.
Right.
The companies that don't are perpetually in this trouble. I just read an article recently about how the major carriers in the United States are now buying planes from both Airbus and Boeing that have less fucking room for us. And they've figured out how to make their toilets even fucking smaller. And I don't know how tall you are. You look like
I'm 6'4" and I've been in some of those toilets.
Yeah. And I'm 6 feet and I can barely get my ass in those toilets. So those toilets. So, you know, I read this stuff and I go, are you people fucking mental like this? Yeah. You're going in the wrong direction. And yet there are these other companies and technology companies and so many others that are like tripling down on experience. And so what's this weirdness in sort of this big bifurcation between people who get it and people who don't?
Well, I think that's a great way of putting it. I love the word bifurcation, but there's all, you know, and you're talking about on the supply side, but recognize there's also a bifurcation on the demand side that people want goods and services, most goods and services they buy to be commoditized. They want to buy it at the cheapest possible price. And the greatest possible convenience. So they spend their hard-earned money and their hard-earned time on the experiences that they enjoy. So yes, if you recognize, like, you know, you can upgrade to economy comfort, you can upgrade even to business class, or, you know, get a lie-flat bed if you're going overseas and that sort of thing. But they look at the amount of money and say, okay, this, I just view this as a service. I'm just going from point A to point B in this airline, right? I don't care. I know I'm going to be uncomfortable. It's only going to be 2 or 3 hours. But then with the several hundred dollars I saved, I'm going to go to Dave and Buster's, you know, for the evening. Or I'm going to go to a casino and blow it. Or I'm going to go someplace else. And they're going to spend it on experiences that they really value. So if airlines want to get out of that, they have to get to the point where they view the journey as the experience, not just the cattle car service of getting from point A to point B, and get their consumers to do that as well.
So does that mean the assholes running United Airlines have said, we don't care about experience. We are a time well saved company, not a time well spent company. And we will treat you like shit, and we'll jam you into this toilet, and we'll do all these horrible things to you, because if you want an experience, you need to fly with somebody else.
Right. Although Southwest Airlines, Herb Kelleher again, showed that it can be done, right, to be a cattle car and yet have a great experience.
Right, because I'm a guy who loves
their people be great.
I'm a guy who pays up for experiences big time.
Right.
And Southwest is my favorite airline.
Right.
Now I did love Virgin America, but you know, Sir Richard left us alone here in the United States. God, I don't know if I could forgive him for that, but that's a different point. And so if I'm a CEO today and I'm, you know, I'm thinking about maybe my next big step in my growth strategy, I want to produce, you know, a breakthrough in growth. What would you advise me to be thinking about in the domain of experience?
Well, I would, and we talked a little bit about this, but I would, one, look at demand generating experiences that do the job of marketing. And one of the things I tell companies is to gut your advertising budget and put it into experiences. because, you know, advertising just doesn't work the way it used to in today's media fragmented world. And instead, take that money and put it into an experience where you get people to spend time with you. And you can actually, I got a little efficacy of formula, right? You look at what the efficacy of an ad is. Well, it's how many people saw the ad divided by the, you know, the price of it. And if you look at it with experiences, how many people go to your experience? Now, maybe you can reach more people with an ad, right? And you still have to do that if you've got some big announcement, you got new product position or something. But if you create an experience like American Girl Cafe, like Apple, like Heineken and all those other companies we talked about, then for the number of people, think about how much time they're spending with you. I mean, how much time do you spend with an ad? It's seconds, if you're even paying attention. How much time do you spend in these experiences we're talking about? Minutes, hours, sometimes even days. And so the amount of time they spend, you know, it hugely increases the efficacy. And then look at the intensity of the experience. When you immerse me in a place and I'm totally engaged and giving you my attention versus what you do with an ad. So you have higher attention, you have greater intensity, and then you have greater memorability, right? You're going to remember it. And the longer you remember it, the more chances you're going to interact with that company again, buy from them. You're going to tell other people about it. It becomes a word of mouth advertisement in itself as an experience. And you divide all that by the cost, and the back of the envelope calculation is going to tell your CEO that this is a better place to put your marketing dollars.
It's so interesting because this is going to sound corny, but I have thought of you often as the pop-up movement has exploded.
Yes.
Right? I noticed it first in restaurants, and obviously it happens in retail locations a lot today. And you have other, you know, of course, food trucks are sort of, if you will, a pop-up, right, if they move around. And it's interesting to me to see companies creating, quote-unquote, these are the exact terms they use, pop-up experiences, where they show up, they do this thing, and then they get out of Dodge. And they, right, to your point, they've gotten your attention, they've done something at some level of intensity, and they've created some kind of a memory.
And they've also gotten you to often memorialize it in your photos, in your selfies, with it as the background that you then put on shared media and social media, and then you're spreading out there in the world. One of the sort of new genres of pop-ups is things like the admission feed Museum of Ice Cream. You know, you pay $38, and basically all it is an Instagrammable set after Instagrammable set, where you're, yeah, taking selfies in these places, taking pictures and sharing them. And there are other things like that, you know, the Rosé Museum and others. So you see more and more of that sort of thing happening. I just read that there's a mall in New York State somewhere that's going to devote an entire floor, as more and more retail shops are getting out of it, they're going to devote an entire floor to online companies that don't have a retail presence, and let them pop up in there and see if they can get going with the physical retail. You see that, you know, the Warby Parkers and the Bonobos of the world and how they're creating retail presences after first being online. Why? Because they recognize how much of a greater experience that you, yeah, can create in the physical world.
Well, and it's interesting. It seems like as digital experiences are such a big part of our day, we're now all craving physical, real experiences, right? And right, so there's an interesting sort of pull back in that sense. I'm glad. I think you deserve some credit for this pop-up movement, is what I'm trying to tell you.
Hey, I'll take it. You know, yes. We actually have a framework called the Placemaking Portfolio. We didn't publish it in the Experience Con. We actually published it in our follow-on book called On Authenticity. And we talk about how advertising, is, and also in addition to not working as well as it used to, is a phoniness generating machine. So create places where people can experience who you are. And in that framework, we basically outline, this was 2007, that there is a permanent half and then there's a temporary half. And we didn't use the word pop-up. I think they sort of, that term sort of generated after that. But we talk about creating temporary places. And one of the things there is it does have that scarcity effect. You know, it's going to be there for a limited time, so people want to experience it before it goes. And it allows you, when people know it's a pop-up, it allows you to get away with certain things that you might have to spend a lot more money on if they thought it was a permanent place.
Yeah. And I also, just as a side note, I think it's great when restaurants do it. You know, they do like a pop-up inside the restaurant, and maybe that's the dessert or the appetizers. They bring some. It's a fun add-on. Now, I did want to get to this authenticity conversation, because obviously it's a word we hear today, another thing that you've been very forward-leaning on. And it's a word we hear today a lot, and I have opinions about it as a, you know, three-time public company CMO myself. But I'm very curious, if you're advising a CEO who says, hey, Joe, you know, I read about all this authenticity stuff, and you're talking about it and telling me about it, and okay, so how do I be authentic if I'm a CEO of a company and I want to kind of get with the program here?
Well, when we came out of the experience economy, one of the pushbacks we got about how this was inauthentic, you know, it was fake and phony. But what we realize is that as life becomes more of a paid for experience, that people increasingly question what is real and what is not. And increasingly people don't want the fake from the phony. They want the real from the genuine. And for the most part, right, when I'm just sort of at a surface conversation, you know, I talk about this and the need to we could use the term render authenticity, but you get down below that. If I'm really talking to a CEO, I tell them that there's nothing you can do about authenticity. You're fake no matter what you do. we actually read all these philosophers, you know, so you don't have to, about what they say about authenticity. And what we came up with is that there's this 3M model that what philosophers, first of all, they almost never define authenticity. They define inauthenticity, and they say, don't do that or don't be that. And how they define, as they say, is that you're inauthentic if you're of man. You know, in other words, if it's society's dictums, that you're doing things because of society tells you to. You go back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau's idea of the noble savage that throws off the dictums of society and go and becomes himself. And then secondly is that you're inauthentic if you're of machine. You know, the dehumanizing aspects of machine. You think about Charlie Chaplin's movie Modern Times and all that, and how mass production really turned humans into machines where they're just another cog in the wheel. And still today, so many companies treat their employees like machines. And you go back to the airlines where, you know, you sit in the chair and you shut up and don't complain about it, right? Effectively, you're that way as well. And then thirdly, the third M is that something's inauthentic if it's of money. You know, if you do it just because of money, we have the term selling out. If somebody sells out, you know, it's not because they want to do it of who they are. They're just pleasing somebody else and they're going to make money at it. And so if you think about it, all economic offerings are of man, of machine, and of money. You know, they're of money by definition. You're selling something to somebody else. They're of machine with all the technology today that's used to manufacture, to market, distribute, and so forth of offerings. And all corporations are incorporated by society that gets to tell them and regulate them and, you know, what they do and so forth. So you know, to use a big word, we say that all economic offerings are ontologically inauthentic, right, in their being, but phenomenologically, how people perceive them, they can perceive them as real. And absolutely we do. We talk about offerings. We talk about companies that we perceive as real. So you get down to that level and you got to tell the CEO. So what you have to do is you're managing perception. You have to manage the perception inside your customers' minds, which is why it relates directly to experiences, because that's where experiences actually happen, is inside our own minds as we are stimulated by some environment. That then you have to get to managing that perception so they come to view your offerings and by extension your places and your company as authentic.
And so if I wanted to be viewed as authentic, how do I begin to center myself on, you know, because when I hear create perceptions, it immediately fires up inauthenticity, right? And one of the weird things, right, you know, in marketing terms, when I hear it today, the more I hear the word authentic used, the more inauthentic I think the asshole talking to me is, exactly, by definition. And so if I authentically want to be authentic as opposed to sort of manufacture a bullshit smear of authenticity on what I'm doing, how do I get real about authenticity,
right,
Joe?
Right, exactly. We actually have these axioms of authenticity where you say, you know, if you are authentic, don't say you're authentic, right? Number one. Because number two, if you say you're authentic, then people are not going to perceive you as authentic. And the easiest way to be authentic is not to say you're authentic. So you don't want to say it, right? You just want to do things. And so we have in there the two key standards of authenticity. And these actually flow from what we think is really the first time that authenticity came to the fore in English literature, and that's Shakespeare's play Hamlet, the most existential of plays, to be or not to be and all that. But the most fake character in the play is Polonius. And there's this scene where he's giving this long series of advice to his son Laertes, who's about to go off to France. And he gives him platitude after platitude and cliche after cliche until the very end, Polonius, or rather Shakespeare through Polonius, says something profound, something that's never been said before, right? And this above all, to thine own self be true. And now you know, actually losing the second line. And as night to day, thou canst not be false to any man, right? And in there are the two key standards of authenticity, about being true to self, and then not being false to any man is not about the self to which you must be true, what we recognize all as a key authenticity standard, but about how you represent yourself. And the question is, do you represent yourself in truth or in falsehood? So to the CEO, you got to understand is, are you true to self? Are your offerings true to who you are as a company? Are your places true to you? Are you as a company, as the CEO, true to the company? Because a lot of companies fall down when the CEO does stupid stuff that gets them branded as phony. Think about BP and the oil spill in the Caribbean Gulf. So you got to examine who you really are. What's your purpose? Why are you in this world? What's the nature of your offerings and the nature of your company and so forth? And then the second standard of being true to about being what you say you are is you need to then ask, what is everything you say? Which is like in your public announcements. Why do you say you're in business? What do you put in the look and feel of everything, right? Your appearances, how you package things and all that. So it's representation versus offering. But if you want to truly be perceived as what we call real, then you got to be authentic on both of those, being true to self and being what you say you are.
I think it's so powerful, and it seems so hard for so many companies, right? If I look at the company I'm hating on the most right now is
that Comcast or United?
Yeah, they're always right there. But there's a very special evil going on right now, as far as I'm concerned, with Pacific Gas and Electric.
Oh, yeah. That's the fires in California.
Well, these assholes are responsible for some meaningful percentage of these fires. We know that. And now, to quote, protect themselves from the lawsuits from the peoples whose lives they fucking burnt down, they're going bankrupt so they don't have to pay people what they owe them. At the same time, these fucking assholes, literally a month ago, they've probably taken them off the air now, were running ads about how much firefighters love PG&E. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my question is it possible for such inauthentic lying assholes to ever get better, or is a company like PG&E just going to be evil and that's just it? Because when they run these ads with the PG&E worker with the arm around the firefighter and the firefighter saying how awesome they are, like, I just look at that and go, yeah? Well, fucking A, why don't you help firefighters? Why don't you help the victims of these fires as opposed to run these fucking ads, you assholes? But that's just me. Is a company like that fixable, or are they just going to be assholes forever?
Right. It's not just you. I do think it is possible to fix it, but it's a sort of thing that takes decades of, concerted effort and to be able to get to the point where people start to trust you again, of having integrity, of doing all the right things to be true to self and be what you say you are. But it's not months, it's not even years. That sort of thing, when you fall back from that, can take decades.
Yeah, the other one, it's not quite as evil, but I think it's close enough. Is fucking Wells Fargo. It seems like they get caught once a quarter doing some evil thing to their customers, and nobody goes to jail. Maybe somebody gets fired, but and so they can, fine. Some fine of 50 $50 million, which for them is nothing, you know, so they can run as many stagecoach ads as they want about how they pioneered the West and all that. They're never getting a dime of my money because I just think you guys are the most inauthentic, spreadsheet-loving assholes. Right. Go fuck yourselves, right?
Right, right. But the stagecoach is absolutely an appeal to authenticity that talks about how long we've been in this business, how we originated, you know, one of these. So, but if you're just appealing in your ads versus what you actually do, right, that's never going to work.
So for authenticity to work from a, let's call it a business or a marketing point of view, you actually have to have a company with some fucking core values.
Yes, yes. Okay. You got to have a body of values. You got to have a sense of purpose. It's one of the things I'm big on now is that companies really do need a meaningful purpose that aligns with everything does. And that's become sort of the North Star of who we are. And then you know whether you're being inauthentic or authentic, or whether it fits in with the purpose and the body of values that you have.
And let me ask you the question. I think I have a pretty good idea of the answer, but like, okay, so why do I really need to have a purpose? Isn't my purpose just to make money here, Joe?
No. If you consider your purpose just to be making money, then you're right there in the selling out, right? All you care about is money. And so I can actually appeal to you on that level, though, to say the best way to make a lot of money is to not focus on making the money, but to have a purpose that society values, that customers will value and align with, that allows you to then to create offerings that people will then pay you money for. But it's why you really exist. And without it, your employees, you know, I've always thought that companies in terms of authenticity corrode from the inside out. You know, it's when the employees stop believing in the company, yes, that you're dead. And that's then going to show in all of your interactions with your customers. And when things happen like this, how you as executives make these, you know, stupid decisions, instead of having a purpose that aligns what the employees do, the decisions the executives make, and then from flowing out from that is then how people can perceive you as authentic.
And so maybe let's go to a company that's been in the news lately and I hope they're not a client. You can kick me under the table if you don't want to talk about them. But, you know, you take a company like a Facebook, mm-hmm, who I think...
Not a client.
Okay, good. So let's talk about
them. I'm not even a user. Well, I'm not even on Facebook.
Now, that's an interesting thing. Why aren't you on Facebook, Joe?
There's only so much time in the world, and I just decided that's something I don't have time for. I'm on LinkedIn because I get business from LinkedIn. But you know, I just don't need to talk to, you know, so many people from my youth and other things and keep up with all that stuff. The people that I want to keep up with will find a way to connect.
But you think not as an advisor or as an author, as a speaker, you know, you're a very big person in the world. It's sort of an interesting platform for you to opt out of, you know, given your look, everybody today, they want to be an influencer and a thought leader. Right, and, you know, right, you hear all this shit, it makes me want to punch people in the face. You actually are one because you actually did substantive work and you put that work together very thoughtfully and you brought that work to the world and you were right. And anyway, my point is there are very few quote unquote thought leader, influencer, speaker, guru type people in the world or wannabe type people in the world, not on Facebook today. It's an interesting choice for someone in your profession to say, fuck the biggest social network.
Right. Right. Well, it's just, you know, I think of, again, it gets back to time, right? Everything's about time. And there's only so much time in the world. And is that something I want to spend my time on instead of making a difference in the world with my purpose? You know, I view my purpose as figuring out what's going on in the world of business and then developing frameworks to first describe what's happening and then prescribe what companies can do about it. And yeah, there's things I could learn from Facebook. There may be some business connections that I can make from there, but I've got enough of both of those, and I'd rather spend my time reading a book than, yes, you know, than being on Facebook, frankly.
That's fascinating. So now Facebook seems to be a company to me that at least in part has lost its way. I think at some point it felt like a more purpose-driven, yep, company, yep, to me, just as a user. Right. I have some relationships there.
To connect the world and understand the social graph and so forth.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of value to that, and I think it creates a lot of value for a lot of people. But then all of a sudden we start learning about there's been a big negative breakthrough in suicide rates in our country, and you start to track suicides to smartphones and social media, and then you look at the impact it has on, you know, people, and all of a sudden starts to get negative. And then you find out they're, you know, selling our data, and they're doing all this horrible shit. They're even, you know, when we found out they were selling our message data, like the messaging that you and I do personally, and instead of email or text message, we do it on Facebook, they're selling that, you know, giving that away to people. Like, they just now seem rotten. And so what advice would you have for a company like that who, if we would say in the beginning, maybe had a more altruistic, more powerful, more authentic, principle-centered approach, but seems to have lost their way? How do they get their authenticity and their core values back?
I think there's only one way, and that's to go back to its original sin. Its original sin is becoming an advertising platform. And, you know, I already talked about how advertising just doesn't work the way it did before. I talk about advertising as a phoniness generating machine. And so this advertising is a corrupting a mechanism that it just corrupts how you think about your users, right? If they're not the customer and your customer is advertising, it's the one access to those users. So now you're going to start, because that's who you're really serving. Is you're serving ad companies or serving marketers and brands that want to reach consumers. That's who the real customer is. So you got to flip that, and you got to make Facebook users the real customer. And there's one simple way of doing that is you charge them.
Yeah.
You charge them. The one of the things that we got some of the most pushback on when the experience economy first came out was where we talked about you need to charge admission for experiences. And because it's charging for time. Again, experience is about time. You know, if you charge for undifferentiated stuff, you're in the commodities business. If you charge for things, you're in the goods business. If you charge for the activities your people perform, you're in the services business. But you're in the experience business economically, if and only if you charge for time. And that means an admission fee or a membership fee or some other way of charging for time, time well spent. And that's what they need to do. They need to start charging for it. And maybe they just start with a premium level. That, you know, and a lot of people do this premium level, skip the ads, you know, YouTube. I can get on YouTube and pay to skip all those ads and pay to not have my data be siphoned off and used by other companies. And that's what they need to do. And what they're going to find when they do that is that a lot of the people are going to want that as well. And they're going to bring that down to where most people would be happy to pay. You know, look at Netflix, right? They just went from $11 to $13 a month. But how much time do you spend on Netflix versus Facebook? It may be, for some people, it's one maybe more than the other, but it's the same sort of thing. Charge them $10 a month,
right?
And then let them become the customer. And then all of a sudden, you'll find all these wonderful things you can do for them because they're paying you, rather than do things at them and against them because some advertiser's paying you.
It's such a profound but yet simple insight, right? They did lose their way, and they did lose their way because they stopped focusing on the user and the user experience we wanted. I mean, Zuckerberg became Person of the Year for Time Magazine, and in that article, he talked about trying to digitally create trusted relationships, this thing he ultimately called the social graph. And when the company was focused on that, Facebook was cool and it was fun.
Right.
Yeah. Very fascinating. Well, Joe, I could talk to you for hours. What other things do you think you want to touch on before we wrap?
Well, I would add at least one more thing, which is that experiences are not where this progression ends. You know, we talk about the progression of economic value from commodities, growing economy, goods, industrial economy, services, service economy. Today, we're in experience economy. But in fact, there's one more economic level. Because experiences can be commoditized as well. You know, experiences may be the easiest economic offering to commoditize because the second time you have an experience doesn't tend to be as good as the first. Third time, not as good as that. And when you get customers saying, been there, done that, then you're going to have a commoditized experience. So the next level is to think about those experiences that so engage us that they actually change us in some way, what we call life-transforming experiences. And so these are what we call transformations. Transformations are the fifth and final economic offering in this progression of economic value. We're using experiences as the raw material to guide people to change. You know, you think about fitness centers. people only ever go to fitness centers because they want to change, whether it's to lose weight, whether it's to get more toned, whether it's to fit in their, you know, their swimsuit for the summer, whatever it might be. They've got a particular aspiration and they're hiring the fitness center to help them achieve that aspiration. Often they don't do a very good job because they view themselves in the experience business. But if they viewed themselves in the transformation business, they would look at outcomes. You know, healthcare is all about transformation. People want particular outcomes. So last year, the CEO of Medtronic was in the Wall Street Journal, and he talked about how they're moving to outcome-based pricing, right? And that's the way it ought to be. You know, if you charge for time, you're in the experience business, but in transformations, you want to charge for the demonstrated outcomes that your customers achieve so that I pay you only if you actually help me achieve the aspirations that I want. And that we're going to see more and more, and we're seeing that outcome pricing more and more. Any business that's in the business helping companies become healthy, wealthy, or wise is in the transformation business and needs to think about how they move to outcomes-based pricing. Because with transformations, the customer is the product.
Yes. It makes so much sense. You know, I talk to friends who are in the consulting business, and I spent most of my life as an entrepreneur and operating executive, but I've been in the sort of advisor consulting space off and on. Right. And this is the conversation I always have with them, which is like, okay, so, I just had this conversation with a buddy of mine, and he's working with this company. And I said, okay, so tell me what you're doing and tell me all about it. And then I said, what'd you charge him? And he said, $500,000. And I think he expected me to say, well, you know, that's a great consulting fee, right? And I said to him, we'll just call him Jimmy. I said, well, Jimmy, that's a great consulting fee, but, you know, they're going to go public based on, in large part, a lot of this work that you did for them. And what do you think their market cap's going to be? And he said, well, you know, back of the envelope, he said, it's probably going to be around $2 billion. I'm like, okay. How much of that value did you help right. them create? I'm not exactly. suggesting he was responsible for the $2 billion.
No, but some portion of it. You know, some portion. From 1.8 to 2, let's say.
Exactly. An incremental $200 million. Incremental in air quotes, right?
Right, right.
And so it's like, okay, well, so the $500,000 consulting fee is really great, but these guys are going to have a $2 billion outcome. And so the question I asked him in this context is, was that a fair exchange of value? And, you know, you could see his eyes get wide and like, okay, right. so.
Did he have tears coming to
Well, I didn't mean to make him feel shitty because he thought right. he was doing great, you know, because right. if you're a small consulting, you know, group of folks and, you know, $500,000 gig's a good gig. But it is very interesting that, so the next level, we go from experiences to transformations. And in transformations, the customer is the product, and the journey they go on, the from to journey they go on, we then get paid based on the value that gets created when the to outcome occurs.
Exactly. In fact, I mean, I find it amazing that you just used, right, yourself, these phrases that I use all the time, you know, about charge, you know, what you told your friend about why aren't you getting a piece of that, because you made a difference in the outcome. It's worth it to them. And from to, right, that's what transformations are. They're from to. What's your from to statement? Where are they today? What do they want to become? And how do you help them achieve that aspiration of going from this to that?
Awesome. And I assume you'll continue to write on these topics?
Absolutely.
Do we have a timetable on when the next
book? Well, we're actually coming out with a new hardcover of The Experience Economy this fall. And I'm
awesome.
Working on the new preview for it, you know, right now, you know, as we speak, to be able to set the stage for that. And I'll be talking about transformations in there, even an authenticity in there and so forth. You know, the subtitle is Capturing Customer Time, Attention, and Money. Right? And that's what you do with experiences. Back to your original, what do you tell the CEO is, if do you want to capture customers' time, their attention, and their money, here's how to do it. It's with experiences.
I love it. And actually, if you're so inclined, I would love to have you come back you know, have this conversation again as the updated book comes out with new examples and whatever you're thinking about at the time. And I definitely want to drill into more of these transformation type ideas. I think that's very, very, very powerful. And amen, hallelujah on outcome-based pricing.
Exactly. Thank you, Chris. I'd love to come back too.
Well, I'll have you anytime you want, Joe. I'm a huge fan. I really, your contribution to the business world, I think, is incalculable. I have no doubt that you get love notes all the time and and all that stuff. But we can end here. Did you guys know in 1999 that you were going to be the godfathers of all of this?
we sure hope so. You know, we knew we were onto something. We knew that this is what was happening, and you know, we did hope and pray that things would if they just continued along the path that we had already seen, that you know, in 10, 20, 30 years, that this would be a huge, huge thing.
And so, you know, just on the personal side, you know, what does it feel like? I mean, you have to know you've been such an important part of such incredible set of thinking that's made a big difference, not just in business, but in people's lives. Like, people's lives are better because companies think this way.
It isn't, you know, when you think, you don't often think about it, but when you think about it, it is very gratifying. You know, I've got my own work, like when I do a speech, and I see the light bulbs come on and people talk to me afterwards about, wow, you know, I get it. I see what you're doing. We need to make a difference in our own company. Or I do some consult workshops and consulting with companies, and I can work with them over time and see what a difference that it's making with them. But also, it's just that there are people that come up to you or send you an email or, you know, or connect with you on LinkedIn, and then you connect back and they say, oh, I've got to tell you how much of a difference your book made in my life. You know, there are very few more gratifying feelings than to get responses like that.
Well, I have no doubt you get a lot of them because you've made a giant difference. Joe, I'm a huge fan, as you could tell. I really appreciate you investing this time, and you're welcome back anytime when the updated version of the book comes out. I'd love you to come back and share some more of the thinking.
All right. Thanks, Christopher. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, fuck yeah, Joe Pine on the podcast. That was awesome, man. Oh man, what an incredible guy! I bet you took a notebook for you know, if you're gonna have a podcast, you should learn how to talk. That is to say, I wouldn't be surprised if you took an entire notebook full of notes in that conversation with the amazing Joe Pine. Now, is it growth time for your business? NetSuite wants to help you master growth. NetSuite's order management capabilities help you streamline the entire order processing process, removing manual bottlenecks, preventing errors, establishing a very smooth flow. And who doesn't want a smooth flow? From a sales quote to order fulfillment to replenishing your inventory to making sure that you get that invoice out. And most important, where's the money, Lebowski? Making sure you manage your payments effectively. The entire process. That's NetSuite. NetSuite's billing management capabilities integrate sales, financing, fulfillment, and more to improve quote accuracy, eliminate billing errors, strengthen revenue recognition. And if there's one thing you don't want to be weak, it's weak on revenue recognition. And drive fulfillment and accuracy throughout the order process in your business. Now, I encourage you to go to netsuite.com/different, because as a listener to this podcast, NetSuite is offering you an opportunity to spend 1 hour with an expert in your industry talking about opportunities for growth. So go to netsuite.com/different today. All right. We would like to thank the amazing Joe Pine and his firm, Strategic Horizons. You can find them on the web at strategichorizons.com. And how about Niche Down, the number one best-selling book by Heather Clancy and myself. Niche Down, How to Become Legendary by Being Different. Check it out on amazon.com. The incredible nonprofit, onelifefullylived.org, helping you dream, plan, and live your best life. The number one, lifefullylived.org. GrowWire.com, it's what legendary entrepreneurs are reading, featuring stories of innovation. Check it out, GrowWire.com. Now, is it time to help scale yourself? You need some help? You need it to be cost-effective? Well, why not check out Bottleneck Virtual Assistants and leverage the power of a virtual assistant at bottleneck, all one word, .online today. And are you in the tech space and in B2B? Then check out Otranet. ATRE.net. They've been building B2B websites for technology brands in Silicon Valley for the better part of 20 years, and they know what they're doing. Check them out, ATRE.net. And our friends, the amazing people at the Front Row Foundation, they support folks, often young folks, who have life-threatening diseases in having a life-changing experience. And so if you want to help fund one of these experiences for one of these people, it'll really change your day. Trust me, John Vroman and the folks at Front Row do an incredible thing. So check them out, frontrowfoundation.org. All right, I need to remind you that this podcast is the sole property of the Lockhead Podcast Network. All rights do remain perturbed. We must warn you that this podcast is clearly produced in a studio that does contain nuts. Teach people experiences. In the event of a water landing, this podcast could be used as a flotation device. Only fart in an elevator with three or more people in it. Think about it. Listen to Blue Rodeo. Remember, if you haven't changed your mind lately, how do you know you have one? Radio shows on the internet are not podcasts. Listen to real, authentic, independent podcasts. Thank you, Candy Dandy. I love you, Mom and Dad. And hey, Colin, this podcast really ties the room together, doesn't it? Today, our deepest apologies go to Douglas Parker, Chief Executive Officer of American Airlines. Sorry, Dougie, we just ran out of time for you. That's it, my friends. Thank you so much. And until we meet again, follow your difference.